Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is February 22nd, 2014, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Goldfinger, More Dogma of Laceration Repair. I have a guest skeptic with me today. Her name is Eve Purdy, and she is a third-year medical student from Queen's University with an interest in emergency medicine, medical education, and one of my favorite things, foam. Say hello, Eve.
Hi.
Now, Eve, you have this great blog. What's this blog that you run?
The blog is called Manuette Corde, which means hands and heart, and it's a blog that has kind of two focuses. One looks at evidence around common things that medical students come across, and then the other is kind of a medical student's take on issues related to medical education.
It sounds super sophisticated, sort of like A2 Brute, but in this case it's Manuette Corde. Manuette mm-hmm. Corde. I also hear you're going to Smack Gold next month. Wow, that'll be exciting. Unfortunately, I won't be there, but I'm doing something super exciting as well. I'm going to be teaching in Stockholm, Sweden at Sweetbeam. Now, people attending Sweetbeam should know that there's been some trash talk lately about this conference. Specifically, the organizer, Dr. Katrin Herska, and I have made a little bit of a wager on the Olympic men's gold medal game. If, or should I say when, Canada wins, she has to wear a Canadian hockey jersey at the Sweetbeam meeting. In the unlikely event that Sweden beats Canada in hockey, I will present at the conference wearing a Swedish hockey jersey. But I don't want to go on and on with all this smack talk and trash talk. Let's get on with today's episode of the SGEM. Eve's here doing a rural emergency medicine elective with me, and by the way, she is a superstar. How's the elective going, Eve?
I have nothing but awesome things to say. I must admit I'm getting a bit more skeptical, though.
Good, because that's one of the goals of this elective. Now, one of the questions that came up during the elective was the dogma around laceration repairs, and specifically, in air quotes, the golden period of 6 hours, or the dreaded fear of infection. And we do know from previous research that an infection is the number one concern of physicians. And the quoted rate for lacerations is somewhere between 2 to 5%. So I'm wondering, Eve, how long have you seen doctors go or feel comfortable sewing up lacerations? And these are simple lacerations on your clinical clerkship experience.
So this has been pretty variable for me. I see some docs close lacerations greater than 12 hours, and I've also been in moments when I've suggested that we close something that's been open for more than 6 and kind of been scolded for that. So I kind of see the spectrum in clerkship.
And that's why it's difficult for students and trainees going through, because there is a highly variable rate when it comes to many aspects of medicine. And I think that's one of the important things of evidence-based medicine, because if we have a hook to hang it on and say, well, the reason we're doing this is based on this evidence, maybe we'll get more uniform care, individualized care, but uniformed care and the best care based on the best evidence. So I always like to base these podcasts on case scenarios, Eve. So you came up with a case scenario that we can talk about and get a paper to answer that question about sewing up people after that golden period. So what's the case scenario, Eve?
Sure. So today we're in a rural emergency department, and we see an otherwise healthy 24-year-old man who was out at the bar last night and got into a bit of a tussle around 11 p.m. He woke up the next morning and was surprised to see a 3-centimeter laceration on the back of his right hand. He finally figures that he should get it looked at and makes his way into the emergency department at noon the next day. So this is more than 12 hours after the injury.
So not a very unusual situation where we have a young man standing around, probably minding his own business, doing nothing, and then lo and behold, gets up at the crack of noon the next day and finds out that there is some unidentified injury, or at least that he doesn't have much of a memory of how that injury occurred. So the question for the podcast then is, would you sew up a laceration like this of greater than 3 centimeters on the back of this young man's hand when it's more than 12 hours. So before we answer the question about suturing this, the background information is that we've spoken before about the dogma of wound care, and that was the SGEM episode number 9, Who Let the Dogs Out? And this addressed 5 myths about simple lacerations in the emergency department. And the first one was that patients have priorities. Of course they do. But infection is not the number one priority when it comes to patients. What's the number one priority, Eve?
So for non-facial lacerations, the number one priority is function. You know, does my hand work? Now, for facial lacerations, it's a bit different, and cosmetic appearance is becoming more important for patients for obvious reasons.
So it's on when it's on the face, people are more worried about cosmesis.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's not on the face, they're worried about function. It doesn't mean they're not worried about infection. It's just that it's not their top concern. And although we may not be worried so much about function and cosmesis, physicians tend to worry most about infection. Number two in the dogma of wound care was that the solution is dilution. Tap water was just fine. Now, have you seen people wash these wounds out with sterile water or sterile saline, those types of things?
Yeah, to be honest, I see that more often than not.
So there's nothing wrong with just holding that thing, that cut, under the tap. And if you think about it, what do most people do at home if they get a laceration? A simple laceration, they just turn on the tap and wash that wound out. Number three was non-sterile gloves are just fine, and you can save the sterile gloves for sterile procedures. Again, you've been doing your clerkship rotation. Do people use sterile gloves or non-sterile gloves still?
I'd say the majority of people that I work with choose sterile gloves. I always ask, and most of the time, people still want me wearing sterile gloves.
So it's certainly not wrong to use sterile gloves, and I don't want to be giving that impression. It's just not necessary to wear sterile gloves, and they are more expensive when you are using sterile gloves instead of just clean box gloves. The fourth one, I mean, this one's been around forever, epinephrine. And people are very scared about using local anesthetics with epinephrine. But local anesthetics with epinephrine can go in the tips of everything without fear of any appendage falling off. Are people using local anesthetic with epi?
So again, this is a question that I bring up a lot. And most of the time, the answer is, I know the evidence shows that we can, but I'm not going to use epi anyways.
Nice. So they're aware of the evidence, they acknowledge the evidence, and they ignore the evidence. Well, number five was that simple hand lacerations of less than 2 centimeters do not necessarily need sutures. And we are seeing lots more of wounds being closed with just simple Steri-Strips. When we're not talking about hand lacerations, glue is being used more and more, and also, of course, staples in the scalp. So there are other options, and not every hand laceration necessarily needs to be sutured. Now, you have some good foamy information. What are some other good foam sites that people could go to if they wanted to get more information on the topic of wound care?
Yeah, so Dr. Chris Bond from Sock Mob.
Oh, I know Chris Bond. Chris Bond, very classy guy.
And appropriate for this podcast, too, on Goldfinger.
Yes.
Has a great article called Evidence-Based Laceration Repair. There's a great article on suturing techniques from Life in the Fast Lane. I wrote an article on trying to decide whether we should suture or not suture lacerations in the emergency department.
Great. I'll throw some links up on the blog so people can jump out on those hyperlinks and follow up that with that if they want. But the one piece of dogma that we really have not addressed in any of these podcasts so far is this so-called golden period for laceration repairs. And historically, we've been taught that wounds sutured after more than 6 hours are at higher risk for infection. But what did you bring forward? Because we're always trying to cut that KT window down to less than 1 year. So did you get something that's less than 1 year?
Sure. So I found a paper called Traumatic Lacerations, What Are the Risks for Infection? And Has the Golden Period of Laceration Care Disappeared by Quinn et al. And it was actually just published in EMJ in 2014.
Nice. So we're right in that window. I think it was February 2014.
I think so.
So this month. So the population, what was the population they were looking at in the study design?
They were looking at multiple centers. They looked at lacerations that came into a trauma center, a community non-teaching hospital, and a city teaching hospital. And they registered just over 2,500 consecutive patients with lacerations.
And there wasn't any specific intervention in this because this was a observational. They did it prospectively, but it was an observational trial. But they did multiple comparisons. They had 27 specific patient, laceration, and treatment variables that they were going to go through, with the primary outcome being, Eve?
The primary outcome was infection at 30 days, and they defined this as the patient being seen by a physician and treated with antibiotics within 30 days. They also looked at a few other secondary outcomes that are important to patients, like cosmetic appearance.
And they excluded animal and human bites, so they weren't included in this data set. What did they conclude from their study?
So the conclusions were that diabetes, wound contamination, length greater than 5 centimeters, and location on the lower extremity are important risk factors for wound infection. And they also came to the conclusion that time from injury to wound closure is not as important as previously thought.
So let's go through the results and see if, we put a critical eye on it and go through the results and see if it supports their conclusions. So first of all, they almost had 4,000 patients. I know that you said it was 2,600, but they had 4,000 patients consecutively presenting with lacerations. However, their data set included 2,600 patients, or 67%, that they were able to get complete follow-up. So we have complete records on 67%, or 2,600 patients. And of those, 64% were sutured closed, 24% were closed with glue or Steri-Strips or a combination of both, 7% of that 2,600 patients had staples, and 4% were not closed at all. What was the infection rate, Eve?
Of this large population that they had follow-up for, only 69 developed an infection, which is 2.6%. And they had a tight confidence interval there between 2 and 3.3%.
Great. And it was 2.2% of patients in this total cohort that received prophylactic antibiotics. But what we were concerned about is how long did these people go before their repair? So we were looking at time of injury to time of closure. So what kind of data did they have on that?
So of the 2,600 patients that they had follow-up for, they had a documented time to injury for 88% of those patients.
And here's what you've been waiting for. I mean, this is why these people are listening, Eve, to Goldfinger. They want to know, is there an association between infection and how long people went before closure or repair? And so was there an association between infection and time to closure?
Dr. Milne, there was not.
There was no association. There was also no association between the patient's age, sex, race, or tetanus status. However, there was an association between infected wounds and cosmetic rating. And what was that?
So infected wounds received a worse cosmetic rating with a score of 87 out of 100 on a visual analog scale compared to 70 for those wounds that weren't infected.
So that's not too surprising. If the wound got infected, it got a worse score when it came to how it looked cosmetically. How about scar revision?
So again, infected wounds were more likely to need scar revision. About 25% of infected wounds underwent scar revision compared to 10% of uninfected wounds.
Now they did a multivariate model for predicting or for predictors of infection, and it showed a few things were more predictive of patients getting an infection. Do you want to just go through what those four things?
Sure. So the four things that they looked at or that they found were non-head and neck location with an odds ratio of 2.5, diabetes with an odds ratio of 3.1, wounds greater than 5 centimeters in length with an odds ratio of 2.4, and wounds that were heavy or moderately contaminated with an odds ratio of 1.9.
So lower extremity injuries were more likely to get infected if you had a history of diabetes. bigger lacerations, and they define that as greater than 5 centimeters, and if they were moderately or heavily contaminated, and I think they also mentioned foreign bodies within that contamination as part of that. So those were the four things that the multivariate model for predictors of infection were. All right, so Eve, why don't we take a look at this paper now from a critical standpoint and go through some of the strengths and weaknesses that we were able to identify when reviewing it. And I'll start off with the first strength, and that is that it was a large sample size. I mean, they had close to 3,000 patients that they were able to get follow-up on, and they looked at consecutive lacerations, and the data was collected using a standardized form, and I thought that was really well done. What did you have down for some of the strengths?
Another thing that I really liked was that they looked at 3 different sites. So they looked at different levels of care, and I thought it was really nice that there was no difference between those sites either.
Also, I found that the subjective variables, which can be a bit, concerning sometimes, is they gave explicit definitions of what they were trying to get at with those subjective variables. In addition, they did a sample size calculation, and they knew that they needed 2,500 to 3,000 patients, and that was done a priori, so they got 2,600, and I thought that was really well done. The statistical analysis seemed reasonable. What do you think about their patient-oriented outcomes?
So I liked that they had a secondary outcome that is important to patients.
Yeah, no, it was good because, you know, often we'll get these results and we've got surrogate markers or disease-oriented outcomes. And we know that, especially when it comes to facial lacerations, that cosmetic concerns is the number one patient concern. Another strength I found was that their overall infection rate of 2.6% was quite consistent with other data showing that somewhere between 2 to 5% of wounds through the emergency department get infected. So I thought that was another one of the strengths. How about some of the weaknesses that were identified in the paper?
So one thing that I found was that, you know, this isn't a randomized controlled trial. In medical school, we talk about finding nice randomized controlled trials. But really, that might not be a limitation of this study and more a limitation of kind of evidence-based medicine itself. We can't randomize lacerations that come in after 1 hour saying, we're going to leave this wound open and we'll randomize you to sew you up 12 hours later or not. So I'm not sure that it could be done in a much better way.
Yeah, and sometimes, Eve, the best evidence isn't great evidence, but it might be the best evidence we can get. And there are limits to evidence-based medicine. And certainly we can't randomize people into delayed closure or immediate closure just to see if time makes a difference. And so we might be left with, you know, a good observational trial or a good observational study to provide us with as much information as we can get. One of the concerns I had is I couldn't determine whether this was on adult patients or adults and children. They didn't say specifically. So while I think that this was mainly adult patients, I don't think I can apply this finding without knowing if children were involved. So I think I'm just going to look at this as an adult study and only apply these results to those individuals. Anything else?
So their follow-up was only 67%, and the patients that they didn't get follow-up were just kind of excluded from the analysis.
Yeah, this is a problem because when we look at follow-up, we do like to see 80% plus patients followed up. And if one-third of the patients weren't captured in this study, and they tried to capture these patients by a telephone call, right? And if they didn't capture these people, perhaps they all got infected. Now, I don't think that's true, but if we take a worst case scenario that one third of the patients got infected and then they didn't want to go back to the hospital that did their laceration repair, and perhaps they presented to their primary care physician or to another facility. So we really don't know what happened to those patients, and I think that weakens the strength of the conclusions. I don't think it negates the conclusions, but it certainly weakens the conclusions. How about the issue of blinding, Eve?
Yeah, so blinding in this study is a bit of an issue because the doctors that patients presented to, maybe if they were worried about an infection, weren't blinded to whether it was closed before 12 hours or after 12 hours. And I mean, as we know, there's dogma around this whole issue. So if you're a doctor seeing a patient who has a laceration closed greater than 12 hours, you might be more worried about infection and prescribe antibiotics more readily than if they were closed earlier.
Yeah, and they used that as the definition of whether someone was infected by that they saw a doctor and that they received a prescription for antibiotics. So I agree with you. One of the patient-oriented outcomes, the main patient-oriented outcome, function, was not asked in the study. At least it wasn't recorded. We don't have any data on that. And we know that that's the number one patient concern. And I think this just reflects that when it comes to these types of studies, doctors are really, really worried about infection. And the maybe the most concerning patient-oriented aspects are not captured. So it would have been nice if they had asked some questions around function. Now, what about the fact that we were really trying to find out about patients who had delayed closure or had their, not delayed closure, but had their repair done more than 12 hours after the injuries? How many patients did they actually include in this study?
So there was actually only 85 patients, or 2.1% of the total population, who presented more than 12 hours after the injury. And there was only one of those patients that got infected.
Yeah, and I think that's important that people realize that we don't have a study with close to 3,000 patients presenting 12 hours after their injury. We have 85 patients, or 2.1% of the total cohort, presenting after 12 hours from their injury. And while that might be a bigger data set than other studies that we've been able to find, it isn't as big as 3,000. So how about, were all of those 85 patients closed though?
They actually weren't. 13 of those 85 patients, their wounds were just left open. They weren't closed initially. So really, we actually only have 72 patients who had laceration repairs more than 12 hours after their injury.
And that 13 out of 85, or 15%, who weren't closed, when you looked at the total cohort, it was 3% of the total cohort that presented that weren't closed. So that's five times the numbers. So I think that shows that physicians are still a bit concerned about closing wounds that far out after injury.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's some issue too about heavy or moderate contamination being identified as a multivariant in their multivariate model associated with infection, and that included a time in that. Could you explain that further?
Yeah, so heavy or moderate contamination is kind of a subjective decision, and they tried to give doctors a good idea of what to look for in calling something contaminated. And one of the factors that they gave doctors to look at was time. So moderate contamination were wounds that were open for more than 6 hours, and heavily contaminated wounds were wounds that were open for 12 hours, among other factors, but they kind of mixed in a time variable there.
Yeah, no, I agree. That was a bit kind of odd to try to figure that out. The other thing I was unclear about is they identified diabetes as having a higher odds ratio. In fact, it was the highest odds ratio at 3.1 for predicting infection. And yet they really didn't stratify those patients out and give us more information about patients with comorbidities like diabetes and what happened to them, and whether they had closures with sutures or whether they got presented early or late. We just don't have information of that subpopulation, and it would have been nice to have a little bit more information, especially with that high risk group that they identified. What do you think about their overall odds ratio? Because, you know, diabetes was 3.1, and that was the biggest odds ratio they had. What do you think about the overall odds ratios that they presented?
So the odds ratios that they found for these four factors don't overly convince me. You know, they're not sky high. They're not more than 10. They show that there's a difference, but not one that I'm kind of willing to hang my hat on.
I agree that they weren't that impressive, but I think it is important to know that you do have greater odds of getting infected if you have one of those four risk factors. The bottom line from all of this, Eve, though, was that there was an overall rate of wound infection was low at 2.6%, and there was no good evidence that shows that there's an association between infection and time from injury to repair. Also, there is some evidence to suggest that wounds on the lower extremities, diabetic patients, wounds greater than 5 centimeters, or those with moderate to heavy contamination are more likely to become infected. Clinicians should consider using prophylactic antibiotics in these high-risk situations. So how do you want to close down the case, Eve?
Just to recall, we had this 24-year-old guy who came in with a laceration greater than 12 hours after the injury. And so you examine the wound and you determine it's a simple laceration. And you take a good history, learn that he doesn't have diabetes. And so what I'd want to do is talk with the patient about this and tell him that, you know, for after 12 hours, there's no good evidence to show that we shouldn't be doing this. And there's no good evidence to show that we should be closing it. So you talk with him a bit about that and you decide at the end of the day that he and you think that sutures are a good idea. So you clean the wound with tap water and you use clean but non-sterile gloves for the repair. And you tell him about the 3% risk of infection and tell him what he should look out for and when he should return.
I think that's a reasonable conclusion to the case. So we always like to have a Keener contest. And last week's winner was a repeat winner, actually. It was Constant Kuzma from the Netherlands. And he knew that the Nobel Prizes were awarded every year on December 10th. Eve, you came up with the Keener contest for this week. What do you got?
Sure. So the question this week is, what suture material takes greater than 90 days for complete absorption?
Ooh, a good one. Well, if you know the answer to this Keener contest, send an email to me, thesgem@gmail.com, with Keener contest in the subject line. And if you're the first person to get the answer correct, I will send you a cool skeptical prize. Eve, I haven't filled out your evaluation yet, but you were a star. Do you think you could give the SGEM tagline for the end of this podcast?
Sure. So remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.